Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's podcast, I am joined by wine educator Gillian Handelman and wine master Randy Ullum to tell the story of America's most popular and most drank Chardonnay. How did this Chardonnay conquer the American palate and become as popular as it is? It's a wild, wild, amazing story. Before we do that, I want to remind everybody, SOM Cup of Salvation is playing right now on SOMTV, as well as original documentaries on everything from oysters to vermouth, dozens of wine regions, tons of original shows and education. Go to somtv.com to subscribe and enjoy all of that content now. Without further ado, my conversation with Gillian Handelman and Randy Ullum of Jackson Family Wines. Randy and Gillian, it is an honor to have you both on the podcast. I think all of our listeners know you in some way, whether they know you or not. You have touched more people in the wine business than probably any other two people in the wine business goes. Gillian, you from an education standpoint, and Randy, you from just being behind some of the most popular and widely drank wines in America, I would say. Is that correct? Do you think am I overblowing that?
No, I think you're right on there, especially when you think about the number of bottles we've produced and sold over the past several decades. It's, you know, into the millions and millions and millions and millions of palates, I presume, across America and across the world for sure.
I want to start with how your stories and how you got into wine, how you ended up with Kendall Jackson. And then I do want to talk about a little bit of, you know, do 5 minutes on the Jackson family and Kendall Jackson and kind of how it became what it is. But Gillian, why don't we start with you? You have been doing this for a while. I know you're in your late 20s now. So you've been doing this education and wine thing for a while now. How did you get into this?
Yeah. Well, I got into it like so many people did. I was working off college debt and working in a restaurant in upstate New York in the late 80s. It was a 35,000 bottle cellar. The wine store took one look at me sniffing the glass and said, "Hey, you, get over here. Put on this monkey suit and you're going to work the floor." And so I did that for a while. And I, from what I understand, Mr. Randy was somewhere in those regions as well at the time.
I was.
Where were you?
So I was in the latter half of the 70s. I was in Westfield, New York, along Lake Erie.
Exactly. Working with LaBrusca.
No, that's why I left.
Yeah. Well, I left too. So I headed to Seattle to learn how to make wine, found the grunge scene, found it fabulous, then ended up coming down to Kendall Jackson in the 90s, really 94, great vintage, and worked for the people there, the winemakers at Kendall Jackson for a few years. And then Randy, you know, after that, I realized I wanted to try education, and Jess Jackson is the kind of gentleman who, as you know, is the founder of Kendall Jackson, who said, "Yeah, you want to try something different? Let's go." You know, he was a really entrepreneurial, extraordinary guy. So that's really kind of how I got into wine education.
Are you still in the grunge scene? That's my question.
Absolutely, sir.
So talk to me really quick, Randy. Your position, this is important. Your position at Kendall Jackson is wine master. Is that am I saying this right?
You're saying it correctly, yeah.
And what does that mean? That's a scary title.
It can be, depending on how you interpret it. But it really, because we have so many wonderful vineyards and wineries and enologists and assistant winemakers, associate winemakers, winemakers, and I'm at the pinnacle of that large and fantastic team. And so Jess anointed me as a wine master. We actually have three in the company, myself, Pierre, and Chris Carpenter. We wear robes once in a blue moon, like maybe every 15 years.
Do you really?
We get together late at night.
Yeah, you have incense in that you swing around or something?
There are goats, you know, the usual.
There are goats. Man, Kendall Jackson's a lot more fun than I knew. You know, who knew? So back in the 70s, when you were, this is a really important time in American wine. I mean, I think a lot of what exists now was formed then.
Correct.
Early 80s, 70s. When was the time that the modern era that we know now sort of gelled? Would you say it was, you know, Judgment of Paris time? Would you say it was early 80s? When is, because you were kind of witness to this whole process, what's the moment where this kind of gelled and became you know, the quickening happened.
As in, you know, bringing wine to the consumers in a more Western way versus European way was the late 70s, early 80s for sure. You know, when people would call a Chardonnay a Chardonnay versus, say, a Burgundy, I would say then, you know, and I've been privy to it here at KJ for 30 years now. And it was really when Jess, you know, he made this wine that America fell in love with, and, you know, Chardonnay emulating to a degree, you know, a Burgundy, but bringing it more down to earth where you didn't have to have a PhD to understand it. And it just would bring, you know, joy and a smile to your face. And I think that's the neck of the woods, late 70s, early 80s. Because I know back in, when I was in New York, one of the reasons I left there is I was trying to grow Chardonnay. And it was, you know, darn near impossible along the Lake Erie area because of the cold. It would just get wiped out every winter. So it's kind of a losing battle. But that was when, you know, my heart fell for Chardonnay. And here we are today.
Interesting. You really did. You signed a lifelong lease with this grape, which is a tremendous thing to still be in love with. Still be in love after that many years with.
Oh, for sure.
With Chardonnay.
Yeah, especially because people tend to say, you know, the ABC world, right? Anything but Chardonnay is really kind of a farce, given the fact that one out of four of all of the bottles sold in the United States today continues to be Chardonnay, and the style range couldn't be more spectacular. We're in a golden age of Chardonnay today.
Well, I find a lot of people that whole anything but Chardonnay thing that you said, first of all, I don't hear that very often. I mean, you are in touch more with different levels of consumers than I am. The people that I talk to are mostly either at a very high education level or a very low but very hungry to learn education level. I find most of the people who say that don't know that Chablis is a Chardonnay, and they don't know that Champagne is Chardonnay.
That's true.
They don't know these things, and that's not—
That's true.
That's not, it's unfortunate, but it's all part of the process, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right, so whichever one of you wants to take this, I think it's incredibly fascinating looking at the scope of Jackson Family, how big it is, and how did it get here? Because I do want to get into a lot of things, the sustainability efforts, a lot of the food pairings and things that you are so good at, Gillian, but how did this story with the Jackson Family wines begin, and how did it get to the point it's at right now?
Well, I'll take the first lead on that. You know, it basically back in the, you know, the history, going back to actually to the 70s, Jess and his family lived in San Francisco, and you know, it's very cold and foggy there in the summertime, and he wanted to find a place where they could go on weekends for some warmth and sun, and ended up purchasing a piece of property up in Lake County, about an hour and a half or two north of San Francisco. And that property came with pears, nuts, walnuts, and some Chardonnay was already planted on the property. And he was selling, overnight became a gentleman farmer. And then he was selling his grapes to Barney Fetzer up until basically 79, 80. That's when there was a grape glut. Barney didn't want the grapes. Jess was a stubborn guy. He wasn't going to let them rot. He quickly started studying wine, Burgundy, did some experimentations with his grapes and with some consultants. And he was at age 50, I believe, and he was an attorney. And then all of a sudden, he's becoming a winemaker, and he put together a Chardonnay. And he was very smart, too, very genius, and realizing that, well, if there was a glut in Lake County, there probably was in Sonoma and Monterey and down south. And he realized about the different flavor domains and the flavors and the bulk wines that were available. All these different things came together, and he did some experimentations and then bottled the first bottling of Chardonnay in 81, I believe was the first year. And it just took off. It was an overnight success. And he established that success in the hardest state to have success with California wine, being New York and New York City, because everyone there, you know, in the day, and still to this day, the half of everybody there still loves the European wines. But it took off, and it brought a smile to people's faces. It was called Chardonnay. It looked good. It smelled good. It tasted good. It had a nice, long, lingering finish, and it just each sip beckoned for another sip. It just took off. And so it was almost like an accident that this all happened, but it started to grow, and one thing led to another, and all of a sudden, he's not doing much with his law degree and career, and was full on, became fanatical about Chardonnay and all wines. I mean, it wasn't just Chardonnay. That's what really kicked it off, but He was doing Cabernets and Sauvignon Blancs and things like that. And it just started growing like a, you know, snowball rolling down a hill, getting bigger and bigger to make your snowman. I started 12 years later. I had been at Deloach for a dozen years. And when I started in 93, there were only two brands. It was Kendall Jackson, and he had just purchased the property down in Santa Barbara and in Cambria. And then over the years, you know, Jess wanted to be in control of his own destiny. So he would be buying vineyards or buying land and developing vineyards along the way in the North Coast and Monterey and Santa Barbara, and really got a good feeling for high-end land, high-end and high-quality wines and grapes, being from the cool coast of California, of course, and wanted to, you know, source and again, be in control of his own destiny. So that's why we have accumulated, you know, pushing 14,000 acres these days in a multitude of different wineries. And in the course of all this, created or purchased different brands along the way, keeping the original winemakers intact usually because of the different stylistic differences that each brought to the table. But it also brought locations for KJ to process their grapes. And now we have like over 50.
Gillian, I heard that there was, so there's this lore that there was a stuck fermentation with this Chardonnay. And a little bit of residual sugar ended up staying. And the American palate at that time, because I would ask, like, is this just right time, right place? But is this really true that there was a little touch of sweetness and the American palate at that time
loved
this wine?
Yeah, you have to think about the 80s, right? The 80s being the time of the big hair, the flipped hair. You know, you've got the jelly bellies. You've got, you know, skin-tight spandex. And the 80s were a time of real exuberance, right? And so to come out with this wine that was, first of all, blended from a lot of different regions and really was about fruit, and then to combine that with a small amount of residual, it's really right above threshold. But you think about what that does, it pops the palate, it adds richness, it adds dimension. And first of all, let's not forget, we're mammals. Mammals love sugar. We love carbohydrates. We love fruit. I mean, you know, think about German Riesling. Think about Bubbles. You know, these are all wines that nobody ever turns their nose up. But of course, we know they have a smidge of residual sugar. And so the zeitgeist was just ready for this wine. And the White House poured it. You know, people freaked out about it. You know, they'd get in line to pick up the release, you know, like an Aerosmith concert. You know, it was just I think it really captured something about America at the time.
So many people would, you know, they're talking dry, but drinking sweet or soft sweet. And that's where I go back to, or you didn't need a PhD to understand this. It just felt good. And it made you feel good. And why wouldn't you drink more?
Again, back to some of these major archetypes around the world. There's so many wines that are built on fruit and a little bit of residual that are really, really well loved and respected.
I'm assuming when this came out and the success was starting to happen, I'm sure everybody around copied it or tried to figure out how to do it. The amazing thing is you guys are still America's number one Chardonnay.
Correct.
There's not a lot of, and I'm saying that as a straight fact.
This
is not like, you know, it's amazing to me to be able to keep that momentum for this many years when, you know, that doesn't happen in many industries. It's a very difficult thing. And it has sometimes nothing to do with quality. It's just, how do you stay out front? How do you do that? How have you been able to do this? I mean, especially you, Randy, managing such a gigantic team. How does this happen?
It is all about quality for sure. You know, that's definitely at the forefront of every decision we make. And going back to, you know, just wanting to be in control of everything, by having the majority of the grapes that go into the wine are from our own vineyards. You know, it's 80 to 85, you know, over a 20-year average, a percent. So we are in control of our own destiny with the proper vineyards grown, you know, in the obviously the cool coast of California, which is the best place for growing these grapes. And then on top of that, having a great team in the vineyard, because there are vineyards, and when we ask for something to get done, they're going to do it in the vineyard. So, you know, sometimes an outside grower will do it while you're standing there, and then when you leave, they don't do it quite the way you want. And so that, you know, that's a bit of a challenge. But if it's your own vineyards, you're going to get what you want. The other interesting thing is, you know, because it's barrel fermented, to guarantee the quality of the barrels, we're half owners of a state mill over in France. And so we've done an enormous amount of analysis and testing over the years. We have to keep one step ahead of everybody because, as you mentioned, everyone's chasing us. They don't really have access to those great vineyards, nor do they have any access at all to managing their barrels and barrel sourcing and forests and things like that. Plus the fact that, you know, as you go on and as we all age gracefully together, we tend to get a little bit better at what we're doing. And so we're learning every year, you know, about the soil, the terroir, the right clone, the right rootstock in the right place, and making those modifications, again, trying to stay at the leading edge.
I also have to tell you this really hilarious story about the stave mill, right? It's between Burgundy and Alsace. And Jess and some of his capos got wind that this mill, which had been a furniture mill, could be adjusted to become a stave mill. And they were sneaking around in the dark and sneaking under fences and ripping their pants and things like that, because this is really, you know, sort of like spy stuff, because they knew that the French government was and continues to be very particular about this kind of purchase from American companies. So they got in, managed to save the mill, because they retained all of these people who were about to lose their jobs, refashioned it into a stave mill, and that's what gives us the access to all of these barrels. And since that day, the French government has actually outlawed any other companies from buying a stave mill in France.
Because you saved all those employees? What a horrible
I know. Act. Aren't they so Cartesian?
Yeah, you know, I've spent a lot of time in France. There's some conundrums there, but there are some ways they live that I do appreciate very much.
Agreed.
Then they hated us even more after we were able to, you know, advertise that we could trace the source of the wood in our barrels to a specific forest and guarantee it. And we would also be able to state openly exactly how long those staves were aged in France before being converted into barrels. And no one else in the barrel making world, cooperage world, could do that. And that irked him even more. But now, because we were doing that, you know, it's a French law. You have to have to be able to trace your wood to origin. And it's actually bettered the whole industry.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Interesting. Yeah, that would make sense. That really would. So this is sort of the beginning of the Kendall Jackson Reserve, right? I mean, the Shard. This
Correct.
Is kind of where I started my career, much like you, Gillian, except I was a bartender. And I can't tell you how many bottles of Kendall Jackson Reserve I poured, opened, sold. It was the wine that poured at my bar. I mean, and I can't even – that is like no exaggeration that there were – hundreds of those bottles would get poured.
Well, thank you, good sir. And, you know, it is a compliment from the consumer when they give you a nickname, right? KJ.
Yeah. KJ. That's right. You know, I said that without even thinking.
Yeah.
but that's what, you know, we would call for. We'd carry the cases were all stored upstairs. We had to bring them all down. It was always in a crazy mad rush. And that was sort of the Shard that got poured. And this is before I made any of the films or I really understood what I was doing. It's just one of those wines that became the vernacular, you know, of, kind of what it is, which is interesting, you know, process. Part of the other thing I want to talk to both of you about, you know, we're going to get into sustainability, but Gillian, you are one of the minds in the U.S. that has to do with pairing wine and food. And I just want to spend a little bit of a tangent talking about some of the pairing and then take that into sustainability. Because with making wine at this level, you know, this volume and the amount of care you have to put into it, for you, both your company, your team, to get so deep into sustainability, which is, for a lot of companies, I'm going to say something that hopefully I won't regret. It can be just a buzzword or a marketing thing. I have watched you guys walk the walk when it comes to what you are doing in a way that is not, let's just say it's not to sell bottles. It's to actually make a difference, which is really nice to see. But I do want to start with how in the food and wine pairing, you know, before we were recording, you were talking about how that goes right into sustainability and wine.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really goes back to Jess, because when we picked up the facility where the Kendall Jackson tasting room is now, there was a 2.5-acre garden. And Jess said, you know what, let's turn that into a living laboratory that we can eat from. He hired Jeff Dawson, who had been the gardener up at Fetzer. And Jeff came down and said to Jess, well, I want to plant tomatoes. I want to plant all kinds of things that we're going to feed people with. And I want to plant it biodynamically. And Jess said, I don't know what the hell that is, but go ahead. And so we did. We planted it biodynamically and began to grow all this extraordinary produce that we would feed to our guests and to media, everybody that came to visit with us. And we began to recognize that the protein did not need to dominate the plate just by this very exercise, that a huge range of produce was an extraordinary accompaniment to wine. Secondly, I want to talk about beef, because beef is very, very important to land. We leave 60% of our land unfarmed. It's very important for biodiversity. It's very important to the family to maintain the throughways for the animals, the trees that we cultivate, all of the natural hillsides, the mountains in which we farm. And we need cattle. We need cattle to graze. We need cattle to sequester carbon. Cattle return sod to its natural state from silting. When you mob graze, cattle can do extraordinary things. They can revive desertification. So I think that the buzz around how evil and horrible cattle are, well, that's about feedlots. That's not about grazing. Not only that, when you feed people 4 ounces of beef instead of 12, you demonstrate, as we do, that you can have this extraordinarily healthy meal while still promoting a very healthy practice that sequesters carbon. And lastly, we do a great deal of education around oysters. And when you think about it, oyster bars around the United States, they're huge, right? But at the same time, the smile of the United States and all of the coastlines are beginning to see a huge regenerative world and economy around oysters. They are building jobs. They are restoring waterways. They are extraordinarily good for your body with zinc, B12, all kinds of different compounds that are excellent for your body. They're really a perfect food in many ways. So while we work with our sustainability certifications for our wines, which are important as can be, 100% of our wines and our lands are certified by third-party certifiers. But also, we work very hard to deal with purveyors and to bring education forward that allows more sustainable food to be part of that dialogue. Super important to us.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear you talk about. First of all, you have no idea how much I love oysters. I mean, I made an entire 2 documentaries, one called The Oyster Farmer and one called The Whole Animal, about the exact topic you're talking about. I mean, it's like, this is, I love these two topics so much. The fact that you bring in the idea of food, it's just, God, it's so important. And so I also think wine is food, you know? I mean, you cannot separate the two. It's impossible. And so when it comes to the other initiatives, because one of the things we wanted to talk about on this conversation is just the full scope of what all of you are doing from a sustainability. It's something we talk about all the time on this podcast, whether it's regenerative farming, whether it's, you know, there's a lot of misconception, I think, with the consumer, even with, you know, education, these terms, you know, biodynamic and organic and all of these different things that are very hard to understand. But I think what you are doing is putting things into practice that are understandable. So what is it that you are doing at a volume that I don't think anyone else is doing, frankly? What is it that you are doing?
I want to say, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years ago, but time flies when you're having fun, maybe 10. Sean, actually, Jackson's husband, Sean Casuera, he went out and he started to certify all of our vineyards by region. So we started in the North Coast. Spent a year doing it there. The next year, he went down to vineyards down in the Monterey area and certified them all to be sustainable. And then the following year, he went down and worked at all of the vineyards in Santa Barbara to get them certified sustainable. It was a big deal. He had a great opportunity to visit all the vineyards, of course. And then we, with Katie's, her idea and request, started asking all of our growers and actually offering them a bonus if they would become certified sustainable also. And so the majority of them have, and that allows us the opportunity to showcase that certification of sustainability, you know, on our back label. So that's one of them, just on the sort of on the grape and vineyard side.
But why? Why do this? This seems like such a huge lift. Like what? And I understand. I mean, the environment is incredibly important. But when you're looking at a bottom line and profits and all of these things, why? What was the impetus?
From my perspective, and I'm sure Gil has more to add, but there is a movement worldwide of sustainable farming and sustainability. You know, it's not just having the vineyard be wonderful. You know, it has to do with the neighbors, with the employees, with the wild animals roaming around. It's an all-encompassing ask, really, at the end of the day. So it just makes everything better and then, you know, for everybody. And there's a push. There was and still is a very strong push. You know, people out in the marketplace say, well, are you sustainable? Well, guess what? Yes, we are. I'm proud of it. And then we kind of continued that into, you know, water. Obviously, water is going to be costing the same price as gold at some point. And you really learn that during the droughts. And so, you know, we do a lot of work with water, rationing water, reuse. Like when we're washing barrels, we reuse the water 3 times for that project. We've minimized water use when we're prepping wines for bottling and, the wine's relatively clean. And when we're rinsing our tanks, cleaning the tanks and or rinsing them, we don't have to use chemicals these days because we're using UV light, you know, gigantic UV light bulbs that sanitize the inside of the tank. It's quite amazing. But every drop counts. And I think the number, sort of the rule of thumb, was it would take 10 gallons of water to make a gallon of wine. And we brought it down to sub 5 and 4 and change, which is remarkable when you think about, the amount of wine. So those are all very important things just, for us to feel good and also to represent that, we are folks that worry about the environment and everyone and the future, which leads us probably into the farming aspect.
You know, sustainability is a relatively new discipline. Let's consider that it is exploded, right? It certainly wasn't anything that anyone talked about at the turn of the century, even though people were, by their very actions, sustainable, right? So you think about post-industrial work, there's a whole new social contract that the wine industry has with its consumer, and it's called sustainability. So the certification obviously gives us the credibility, right? But the other thing that it does is it teaches us and it provides us with new areas to innovate, because sustainability is, since it's burgeoning, it's changing, it's morphing into something better all the time as the earth becomes more and more aware of its power and what it can do for humanity. The innovations that it brings back to us are equally as important as the credibility that we show our consumers and the media and the marketplace.
How does this affect the actual taste of the wine, the quality of the wine? I mean,
well, I'd say that going to the next step with sustainability and regenerative farming, getting away from the herbicides and just doing, mechanical tilling, costs a little bit more, but it's better for the land, better for the future. The regenerative part is actually fantastic because you're adding more microbes to the soil. So the vines are healthier and better. The really important part from my perspective of this regenerative farming aspect is sometimes within a vineyard, you'll have a little weak spot where the soils change and you try to build your vineyard and your blocks around all these different spots in a given piece of land. But sometimes you'll have some weaker little knolls. And, by adding a lot more mulch, and we call it green manure, which is basically just cut, you mow the grass or cut the grass, and that has nitrogen in it, and that helps build up the microbe count in the soil. So that it makes for a better grape in the end. So again, it's all those little things. It's like saving money. You know, every penny counts. You think, well, what's 1 cent? Well, you know, 100 pennies is a buck. You know, and all, you know, that stuff, it all adds up at the end of the day.
But Jason, to your point, does the wine taste better? And that's something that is really tricky. A number of people are working on it in the industry. We're certainly working on it. But if you think about that, you have to have a baseline of what your wines tasted like before. You have to train a palate and train a panel of tasters, calibrate them, give them a sense of where they're headed toward in terms of quality. So we are actually working on a trial like this right now with our regenerative practices to see if we think that the quality is improved. But if you talk to people who farm biodynamically, for instance, they say, hey, this is my belief system. I feel better. My vines look better. There's something indescribable about the way that everything, you know, just there's a spirituality to it and an element of life force. That is not something that we will necessarily be able to prove, but we will feel it. And hopefully our customers will as well.
Yeah. I always think when you can get people out in the vineyard more, outside, standing there, looking at things,
right,
thinking about things, it automatic. There's, you can't quantify. It's almost like chaos theory. You can't show this little piece, but you can show the whole thing of how it was impacted by a million little pieces that you can't kind of quantify. So it's interesting. So you guys started a whole initiative, this whole Rooted for Good thing. Explain to me what it is and where you want that to go.
Well, let me start off by saying, and Randy can fill in for sure on this, but it really started in and around 2015 when we got our first sustainability report from an outside agency, right? Starts with social responsibility in our mind. One of the coolest things about working at Jackson is that the family affords each and every single one of its employees 2 days a year to volunteer in their community. Right? That's paid. So that's a real commitment. And it represents, you know, thousands and thousands of hours to, you know, hundreds of community organizations through volunteerism. And that's super important to us. It's also very good for employee morale, right? Secondly, our carbon footprint. We are quite aware of our carbon footprint. We've had our calculations done every year. We've helped to build a calculator for the industry through our partnership with the IWCA, which, of course, as you know, is the International Wineries for Climate Action, of which we were a founder with the Torres family. And we know that offsetting our greenhouse gas emissions is not the way to go. We need to be working directly to reduce those emissions as opposed to purchasing offsets. That's not the responsible action in our mind. Environmental stewardship, as we said already, and we don't need to go over it again, 100% of our vineyards and wineries are third-party certified as sustainable. And we are increasing those certifications regionally as different winemakers and the wine-growing teams wish to do so, whether it's Salmon Safe or it's ROC. We have 600 acres in organic underneath Chris Carpenter that just received organic certification. So that's a really incredibly big part of those pillars. And then last but not least, Randy mentioned water conservation. Not only did one of our people, our barrel workers, determine a brand new technology around, you know, that 60% water reduction, we shared it with the rest of the industry. So these are you know, very, very important pillars. Those are the big four for us. But of course, you know, there's other little bits and Randy can fill in.
Randy, what's the most difficult aspect of what you just said? I mean, the hardest, most challenging part to implement of all of these, the water conservation or the farming aspect of it? I mean, this is such a, to my mind, and I'm not a farmer, I'm not a winemaker, but this sounds so daunting.
Well, you know, it is, but we have a great team and a great force out there, all, you know, after the same thing. You know, and the water one is a tough one because you can't, you know, if you go too far, you end up with problems. Like, you know, we did it as an experiment. I mean, well, let's put all the cards on the table. You know, so we tried to save water and kind of went a little bit too far in our barrels where we weren't quite getting all the tartrates out. Well, we learned after a year that was you know, that winery won an award, great, but they, for water reduction, but for problematic barrels, they've got the award for that too. So you have to be careful, you know, how far you go. The vineyard one is the big one because, and probably one of the most important from my perspective, managing how much water you're putting on the vine and in a very finite and minute way. I mean, the old school of guard would say, okay, we're going to water, you know, every block for 4 hours or 8 hours a day, kind of whether it needed it or not, once a week. And there's a water management tools have become much better where you can know how wet the soil is or moist the soil is all the way down to 6 feet. You know, just give the vine exactly what it needs, but you need to really know what you're doing because you have to also work with the, with Mother Nature. So that is probably one of the biggest challenges I see is being able to get that vineyard into that perfect mode where you're just giving it exactly what it needs and no extra. But that's the magic of vineyard management.
Yeah, and a lot of these newer practices are really teaching us quite a bit about water conservation, right? You know,
right.
I mean,
and the fact that
cover cropping.
Cover crop, not disking everything all the time. I mean, you're wasting a lot of energy and power and diesel fuel if you're going to disk your every row and make it look perfect. You don't need to do that. You know, have grass growing, just mow it every now and then. And that helps with water retention in the soil. And also this whole concept of just the regenerative farming aspect, a richer soil with more microbial activity within it holds water probably 10 times better than not doing it.
Let me give you a good example. We recently had one of our research viticulturalists go out to a regenerative block and take infrared heat images of three different rows. One had no cover crop at all, right? One had cover crop that had been dissed, and the third had existing cover crop that had not been dissed at all. The temperatures are thus. The row without any cover crop was 160 degrees. The row that had been dissed was 98 degrees. And the row that had just existing green cover crop was 68 degrees.
Wow.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. That's pretty staggering.
Yeah, so, that's there's can, truth in that pudding right there.
Right.
Yeah, you can see the water, you know, just the amount of water retention that could exist from the temperature being that low. That's amazing. It almost seems like a cheat code to just leave things alone a little bit.
Doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
What do you see in the next, say, 20, 30 years? You know, obviously temperatures are, you know, might be going up even more. What do you see for the next 30 years with your Shard, with the sustainability movement? I mean, where are we going?
We're going to continue on with the sustainability, of course, in perpetuity forever. One of the things that we're learning and we're doing, you know, already is when we're redeveloping vineyards, you know, just managing them and thinking for 30 years, okay, what's the weather climate like right now? What's it going to be in 30 years? That's usually how long we want a vineyard to last. And is this the right variety for that spot still? Or should we be massaging varieties? Even looking at varieties that aren't as well known at the moment. But there's a lot of thought and process going into it. So you have to plan for it. We all know it's going to get warmer. That's a fact.
Are you guys going to do like a Schiappettino reserve or something? You know, you're thinking about like doing something really obscure?
Well, Albarino.
I love it that you said that. But yes, we are actively working in that area. Obviously, rootstock. Right.
Yeah.
That's a big one. But then also we have begun to plant a number of varieties that we've researched that we know that will potentially offer us a little bit of Teflon from Assyrtiko to Chenin to Albarino to Malvasia. I mean, we know that we have to remain with our eyes on our main business, but we're also going to continue to experiment to ensure that we know where we need to go if we get there.
I'm very much looking forward to a Kendall Jackson Assyrtiko. I'm not going to lie to you. This sounds very, very fascinating. I'm in. Well, I cannot thank you both enough for being on this. It's great to talk to two people who have had such an influence. I really am amazed at the volume and quality control that your company is able to do. It's staggering to me. I don't really understand how you pull it off, but you know,
come visit.
That's why
yeah,
I do what
come
I do.
Visit,
you do what you
please.
Do. Yeah, I will. I will. I will.
We'll show you firsthand.
All right,
Thank you
two, behave
so
yourselves
much.
And go get some oysters and enjoy the day.
All right.
Will do. You do the same. Thank you.
Slurp
Thank
on,
you
Jason.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I really, really appreciate it. If you love this podcast, do not forget to give us a great rating,
Subscribe to this podcast. Tell your friends and your dogs to listen. Really means a lot to us. Go to SomTV.com also and subscribe there to see our new film and see all of the content that we are streaming right now on SomTV.com. I want to thank Gillian Handelman and I want to thank Randy Ullum. And I want all of you to drink something wonderful. All right. And tune in next week.